This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chairman of OMFIF. Today, I'm deeply honored and pleased to be joined by a former colleague and fellow global meeting traveler, Nellie Lang, to discuss macroprudential policies in the United States. Nellie had a fantastic career working at the most senior levels of the Federal Reserve for many years on financial stabilities, and she is America's leading expert of work in this area. She played a critical role in helping America stave off the impact of the global financial crisis on the U.S. banking system. Nellie, among other things, was senior associate director of the Fed's Research and Statistics Division from 2006 to 2010, where she played a prominent role on policies to stabilize the U.S. and global financial systems, including as co-lead on the innocuous-sounding Supervisory Capital Assessment Program, more famously known as the 2009 stress test, which was a comprehensive and seminal work whose transparency and results set the U.S. financial system on the road to recovery amid the crisis. From 2010 to 2017, she was director of what became known as the Division of Financial Stability, where she was the division's first head and led the Fed's efforts on assessing risks to financial stability and on macroprudential policies to mitigate those risks. She's now at the Brookings Institution, a lecturer at Yale, and I often used to see her in the hallways of the IMF. Welcome, Nellie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So macroprudential policies in some ways are new. We didn't speak about them much before the global financial crisis. Macroprudential policy works hand in hand with microprudential policies. But rather than focus on individual firms, macroprudential policy focuses on mitigating systemic risk. It raises issues of measuring and monitoring risk, implementing policies to mitigate systemic risk, and a country structure for doing that. I mentioned your involvement in the U.S. stress tests. We can turn to macroprudential structures, including the U.S. Financial Stability Oversight Council, in a minute. But just to lead off, what are the key macroprudential tools used by global policymakers for banks? We can turn to non-banks later. And how does the U.S. stack up on this front?
So a great dart question. As you say, macroprudential policies are those that are concerned about the financial stability as a whole and trying to promote the resilience of the whole system. And that is in contrast to microprudential policies, which are focused more on the safety and soundness of individual institutions or consumer protection or investor protection. And in those situations, individual firms might be concerned and regulations are designed to protect the individual firms, but they might ignore correlations or other sources of systemic risk. And so there is this need for macroprudential policies because sometimes taking an action just for an individual firm isn't necessarily in the best interest of the system as a whole. And the stress test, which you mentioned, was like a perfect example of that. If every bank needed capital to meet a capital requirement, if they had losses and had to raise their capital requirement, if they shrunk their assets, if they stopped making loans to meet that capital requirement, that would help the individual firm, but it would be bad for the whole system as all banks were to shrink credit. So there has been this growth in macroprudential policies, as you say. And in general, they have started with, as they usually do, with the banking sector. And Basel III, which had its root actually in the middle of the crisis. It was kind of interesting that the international community recognized some of the problems with the Basel II capital requirements immediately and began to work right away, I believe it was in October 2008, at the height of the crisis, to start thinking about reforming capital. So we have Basel III, which tries to take a bit more macroprudential approach for banks. And I think the core characteristics, which you know, Mark, and most people are aware of, involve changes to the capital requirements to not only increase how much and increase the quality of the capital, but also to take actions to offset the procyclicality of capital. And by that, I mean that often capital requirements under Basel II, they would tend to increase after risks and stresses started to rise, not before. So the goal of Basel III is to increase capital before these risks arise. So when the risks arise or shocks, negative shocks come along, banks are resilient to those shocks and therefore aren't going to be destabilizing to the system. So the main capital charges include, one, a new conservation buffer, which banks are allowed to draw down in periods of stress. There are some limits on the drawdown. A surcharge for what are called the globally systemically important banks. And there are now 29 globally systemically important banks designated by Basel, and they have to carry a higher capital charge to reduce their probability of default. And then there's a third element even, which is called the countercyclical capital buffer. And this is, in some sense, the most macroprudential oriented tool, in the sense that countries can raise this buffer in anticipation of stress and then release it immediately in order to support credit to the economy once natural tendencies are to restrict credit because times look a bit risky. So the countercyclical capital buffer, I would say, is one of the most innovative parts of Basel III and is probably the biggest macroprudential tool. The U.S. has put this framework in place. The vast majority of countries have adopted frameworks for implementing countercyclical capital buffer as of 2016. About a dozen countries have actively implemented it. So I think countries are finding that this could be a useful tool. The U.S. make decisions once a year. There is a process in place. The Federal Reserve makes this decision. They recently determined not to activate it, but they do have in place all the other elements of Basel III. So I think just a long answer with some introduction to this whole issue. The U.S. is stacking up, as you say, well, on banking capital regulations and macroprudential policies around the banks. And in part, it has 8 G-SIBs out of the 29. So I think it's important to the U.S. and to the global financial system that they implement these policies as consistent with the Basel III standards.
Thank you for that. And of course, there are additional macroprudential tools such as the liquidity ratios, leverage ratios, and some countries have put in place, I guess, loan-to-value requirements, mortgages, and the like. So evolving panoply of instruments.
Exactly. I would say, so one of the new Basel III requirements was some of the liquidity requirements. And I think there's some discussion about whether liquidity requirements are better microprudential regulations or if they are really macroprudential regulations. Certainly, some entities call them macro. There is some concern about whether in periods of stress, will firms actually use them, draw down their liquidity buffers, which is what you would need to support liquidity in the broad system, or they're going to make sure they maintain their liquidity ratios and then what would be good for the institution is not good for the system. So I think that's a very active discussion and actually a very interesting discussion. Liquidity regulations are new. LTVs are probably the most actively used macroprudential tool across financial systems starting before the financial crisis. I didn't mention those up front because they don't apply only to banks. They basically apply to borrowers. But that is a tool that countries have in place. Fewer countries have frameworks in place to use that. That doesn't mean if they wanted to use it, they couldn't ask for the tool from either their legislative body or some authorities. But they have been used actively. I think there's a bit of research that suggests they can be helpful to reduce mortgage credit, at times reduce house prices. So I think this is an area where lenders are focused carefully on how effective are these, how do you use them, what other consequences might there be to using them. So I think that's an area. The U.S. does not use or currently does not have a framework for using loan-to-value ratios for macroprudential purposes. It is something that the Financial Stability Oversight Council could consider, but currently it is not a tool that they view as being part of their macroprudential toolkit.
Well, that's a perfect lead into my next question, which is about structures. And as you just mentioned, in the United States, we have the Financial Stability Oversight Council. We also have the Office of Financial Research. Both are a product of the Dodd-Frank Act. You and a colleague, Rochelle Edge at the Fed, have recently produced a fascinating paper available on the Brookings webpage entitled New Financial Stability Governance Structures and Central Banks. You look at financial stability committees, such as the FSOC, across the world. I'd love to hear a thumbnail sketch of your overarching findings, as well as how you see the FSOC stacking up in light of your research.
Well, thank you first for calling it a fascinating paper. We found this turned out to be a fascinating topic. This research paper started with questions from other countries, including central bank authorities and regulatory authorities, about how do countries approach the problems of a low inflation or a low growth economy with rapidly rising house prices or rapidly rising household debt burden. Which authorities and countries have the tools to do what, and who's actually responsible? So we started out looking at practices in various countries about, are there macroprudential tools to address this, or is this the responsibility of monetary policymakers? And one thing we noticed was this rise in councils or committees, financial stability committees. And we developed a data set of 58 countries, which include the advanced economies and large emerging markets, most of global GDP they would account for. And we found that 47 of the 58 have created financial stability councils, most of them since 2008. So we decided to look further into, like, what do these councils do? And we found it interesting, one, is that countries created councils, but not new individual entities for financial stability or macroprudential authorities. So they, you know, by inference, we're assuming these countries view that coordinating among existing regulators and central banks is important, and more important than, you know, creating a whole new independent entity for new responsibilities. So all these councils have major prudential regulators and the central bank. What's interesting, we found, was that the Ministry of Finance is now involved in the majority of these councils, often the chair of the councils, and this sort of brings in an elected body, a representative of the elected bodies, into financial stability, which is not usually the case when you're doing financial regulatory policies or central banking. So it's bringing another element into financial stability, which I think just illustrates that financial stability has many objectives because it's about the system as a whole, and some of its goals may be in conflict with or harmonize with other social objectives. Home ownership comes to mind. Expanding mortgage credit is good to improve home ownership. It's for financial stability purposes, it may not be as good if it's increasing debt burdens that households can't service. So we found this to be interesting. I think we are currently working on whether the governance, these institutional structures, how important they are for implementing macroprudential tools. So just starting with, where does the U.S. stack up? The U.S. actually is among the top quarter group in terms of having legitimacy, having set up a good governance structure. And so the characteristics we think about are, is it formal? Is it set up in legislation? Does it have a chair? Does it have some good processes, including basic things like voting? And then the most important, perhaps, is, does it have any tools? So many of these councils, it turns out, more than half of them don't actually have any authorities. They just meet to communicate and perhaps some coordination. But a few of them have active tools. The USFSOC does have tools. It is less limited, perhaps, than the UK FPC or the High Council in France, but it does have some tools in the sense of it can designate non-banks institutions as systemically important. It has a what is called a comply or explain tool where it can issue a non-binding recommendation publicly to agencies if they think there should be new or heightened standards around some of its regulations to promote financial stability. So in that sense, it is one of the better structures in place. I think a broader issue with the governance structures and the committees, however, is that with macroprudential policies, there's a need to be preemptive. So as I mentioned earlier, you want to build resilience in advance, so that the financial sector can provide stability to the economy, not be destabilizing. And you can think of it like being central banks, where they set monetary policy. And you don't wait for inflation to be too high before you raise rates. You anticipate inflation, and so you raise rates preemptively. And this is the old phrase of taking away the punch bowl. Central banks are set up to be fairly independent, operationally independent, so that they can make their decisions with these longer time horizons. Ministries of finance entities are not. you know, they are representing elected officials that work according to election cycles. So there's some concern that the Ministry of Finance entities will not be looking forward enough for macroprudential policies. But as I said, this is new infrastructures put in place. There will be research on how this is affecting the actions, but this is a flag that people are raising in terms of what the appropriate authorities are.
Thank you for that. Looking at the FSOC authorities, over time, the U.S. did designate financial utilities. You used explain and comply procedures with regard to money market funds. And then there were some designations of some other large firms, which has led to considerable controversy subsequently in the U.S. And just listening to your discussion of central banks and finance ministries, as an ex-Treasury person, and this is a subject for another day, but I do think that it's important when financial stability results and hits the public purse or hits the real economy. I think as a result of that, there's some legitimacy in having accountability structures in place. And I think that there is accountability more heavily legitimized when you have a tie into a treasury that is part of a government. That's a personal view.
So I just want to be very clear. I fully agree with that. I think it's a tension that countries have to address. You do need political legitimacy for these macroprudential tools, and especially if you get to a crisis where you actually might be using taxpayer funds. But there's no doubt some tension about policy inertia, willingness to take some actions that might be less popular. But I fully agree. I think a better structure than what we're seeing in a couple places would be the central bank could make recommendations in public, perhaps in their monetary policy report or in a financial stability report. And the Ministry of Finance or the chair of this council makes a decision on that recommendation in public. And so it's the council or the Ministry of Finance who is the accountable entity, but there's a process in place in which recommendations can be made on a bit more independent basis. So a couple of countries implement this process. I think it might be a practice going forward, but that would be useful to many countries. The U.S. does not do that right now. They have in place a process that could move towards that, but that's not the way they're structured now. But I don't want to come across, I apologize if I did that, that I don't think there's an important role for the Ministry of Finance. I think there's actually a very important role.
Well, I think I agree with everything you said. And I'm just an ex-Treasury guy talking to an ex-central banker. So,
exactly.
We've had these discussions before. But that's a perfect segue into non-bank activities, because non-bank activities are not supervised by the Fed in many instances.
Yeah.
And everybody agrees that if you regulate banks more intensively, then activities going to gravitate towards non-banks, and that could raise new systemic risks that need to be carefully monitored and perhaps acted upon. Macroprudential regulation of non-banks is going to be different than that for banks, and indeed the focus on non-banks involves their activities rather than the entities per se. But what are such activities, and what does that practically mean? How does one know if there are systemic non-bank activity risks, and does there need to be a focus on non-bank entities as well? And so what is the U.S. doing macroprudentially to oversee non-banks, especially when it's not the Fed's necessarily domain?
So again, this is a big role for the FSOC, which does try to bring together all the financial regulatory agencies in the U.S. The central bank and the Fed actually has only financial stability authorities for the largest bank, and that was under Dodd-Frank. They don't actually have macroprudential authorities for even some of the smaller banks in the U.S. So I think for the U.S., this has been a big issue. The banking system, it's only a third of the financial system in the sense of it provides only a third of the credit to households and businesses. A good chunk of it is from government enterprises to support mortgages. But then you have securitizations and mutual funds and other kinds of funds that provide a fair amount of credit to households and businesses. So I think a shift to activities is appropriate and has actually been kind of part of the system for a while. And it works in the sense of if FSOC or the OFR or the central bank in their financial stability reports, focus on the vulnerabilities of the system, not on institutions per se, but the vulnerabilities of the system, such as the leverage in the system or the maturity mismatch or the liquidity mismatch, or if interconnections are very complex. then it doesn't matter which firm it arises out of. It's about how much of it is in the overall system. That then lets them focus move to activities. And you can think of activities as kind of like extending credit or market making or key functions to support market functioning. So you identify those practices, you work with the agencies who have their expertise in it. Sometimes it goes across agencies. That's the role of a council to help coordinate. And I think that's why, you know, this move to activities, when you have a financial systems that become more and more market intermediated versus bank intermediated or firm intermediated, it's important to make sure you're covering both. So I think that's how the U.S. is approaching it. It seems to me actually an appropriate way to do it. It's not to take non-bank designations off the table, but it would be not the first priority.
Of course, then there's a difference between having a structure in place and the proper authorities and actually or effectively using the authorities or having in place results or getting results that lead to effective monitoring of the activities. So I'd appreciate any thoughts you might be willing to share on the application of designations or the risk monitoring framework in actuality for non-bank activities in the U.S. So does the U.S. effectively monitor non-bank activities is basically what I'm trying to get at.
Sure. So the U.S. through the council and through OFR and the central bank, I think, have definitely improved their monitoring of activities. And it's not only of the health of institutions and the risks they could pose to the system. And there's better communication among the regulators because of FSOC. And one example, as you mentioned earlier, is the FSOC did use their comply or explain authorities to implement significant reforms to money market funds. And they also agreed to sort of follow up and check and monitor if the reforms were having the intended benefits or there were some unintended consequences. So I think those are important roles and is an example of a good application of their responsibilities for non-bank. The area that I think could benefit a bit more is that I think actually creating accountability for financial stability to the FSOC is really critical. There's still a view that the central bank is the authority responsible, but there is a council. And as I said, the Fed has only financial stability authority for designated SIFIs under Dodd-Frank. The council is the entity responsible to Congress and to the taxpayer for financial stability of the system. So it does need to monitor the activities, publish in its annual report what it views are the risks and whether actions are being taken by the agencies, the relevant agencies to mitigate those risks, or if the council itself should be suggesting further actions. And I think this is important for the U.S. because each individual agency on the council may not actually view themselves as having a financial stability mandate on its own. And so to just say they're responsible, they may actually not have the legal authority. So I do think there's some room for FSOC to step up its accountability for financial stability in the U.S. And this is all in just in terms of good governance and who's responsible for this important responsibility.
Well, thank you. This is a very important issue, given, as you said, that banks provide a third of the credit of the U.S. economy. I very much hope that we are, as a nation, effectively monitoring non-bank activities. I think that given the progress on banks, I think this is a challenge that requires a good bit of focus. I hope you agree with that.
I definitely agree with that.
Good. Well, we've taken up much of your time. I thank you tremendously for offering fascinating insight into the world of macroprudential authorities. I compliment you on your latest work. And again, I thank you greatly for joining us today.